The Legal Sunday, the Constitutional Aspect of the Question, Chapter 5. The objection that Sunday laws are unequal in their enforcement and are class legislation. To prohibit every kind or phase of activity, even of the body, upon the first day of the week would evidently involve the keeping of the entire population in a condition of dreamless sleep during the sacred hours. For, if allowed to dream, some of them would inevitably toss about. And it is in vain to hope that the mass of the American people will ever be induced by the most stringent Sunday law to adopt for 52 days in the year the peculiar form of religious devotion attributed to certain Oriental fakers, which consists in assuming an uncomfortable position and maintaining it indefinitely, awake, yet entirely oblivious to external things and motionless in every muscle. In order to save themselves, then, from the obligation of including the administration of narcotics to the entire population every Saturday night among the police powers of the state, the enactors of Sunday laws are forced to put a saving clause into these statutes. This saving clause not only fatally betrays the true character and purpose of all Sunday laws, but introduces into them an element of uncertainty which, it is safe to say, would cause them to be nullified by the courts if they were anything else but Sunday laws. The standard saving clause of Sunday laws is works of necessity and charity excepted. Such works as these, then, are allowed on Sunday when other works are not. Why?
If Sunday laws are designed to prevent interference with the civil rights of some persons by others, how come either of the exceptions to be made? It is evident that a work might be charitable in the strictest sense of the word so far as A is concerned, and necessary, from his standpoint, to be done for him by B, and yet infringe some civil right of C's. In such a case, where anything but a Sunday law is concerned, the law rightly and consistently declines to admit the charity of B or the necessity of A as any excuse for the violation of C's legal rights. Though I find a tramp starving, I may not rob a store to feed him. On the other hand, if Sunday laws have a civil purpose respecting the individual and are designed to prevent his exhausting himself by continuous labor, why should he be permitted to do works of charity any more than any other work on Sunday? Is it not obvious that he may be quite as readily exhausted by such works as by work of any other kind? As a matter of fact, all persons who engage in what are called charitable works testify to their exhausting effects upon the physical strength, whatever spiritual benefit they may involve. These savings, then, of the Sunday laws, thus considered, sufficiently refute the suggestion that any civil right is intended to be, or is in fact, protected by them. But the saving of works of charity does more than this. It betrays frankly the true nature and purpose of all Sunday legislation. The question of charity is a question of religion altogether. The civil law has and can have no concern with the matter. The civil law says, "You shall not stretch out your hand to smite your brother." Religion says, "You must stretch out your hand to help your brother." The civil law has no means of determining what is or is not charity, or of enforcing any obligations thereof. It cannot possibly discriminate between works of charity and works of any other sort. Enforcing this discrimination upon the courts, by means of the saving of works of charity from the penalties of the Sunday law, the American legislatures have simply forced the courts to deal with a question of religious faith and dogma. Hence it is said, the means which long established and common usage of religious congregations show to be reasonably necessary to advance the cause of religion may be deemed works of charity. 1. Dale v. Knapp, 389.
But not only are the courts thus forced to examine into a question of religion pure and simple, they are launched on a shoreless sea of uncertainty without compass or rudder by this saving of works of charity. They are no more competent to deal with the religious question of what is or is not a work of charity than with any other point of religious doctrine. The uncertainty thus injected into the law is well illustrated by the preceding case. This held that a contract of subscription towards the erection of a church was valid as an act of charity. If so, on what ground is the actual building of the church on Sunday unlawful? Or the quarrying of the stone for its walls? Or the dressing of timber for its interior? In a word, where are we to stop in the degree of closeness of connection between the act in question and the advancement of the cause of religion. It does not seem possible that the subtlest judicial ingenuity will succeed any better in the future than it has in the past in affording a satisfactory answer to this question. Again, it seems hardly consistent with the facts of the case or with verbal accuracy to make charity synonymous with religion. All charity is a matter of religion, but all religion is surely not a matter of charity. Religion concerns itself with man's relation to deity first of all, and, as a necessary part of that relation, with his duty to his fellow man. It is only in this latter connection that it comes to embrace charity. Belief and devotion, public or private, are no part of charity. And while the duty of charity is a religious duty, its performance is not necessarily concerned with the advancement of religion in the sense of the propagation of religious belief or the support of churches, etc. The fact seems to be that the framers of Sunday laws did not regard these things as work at all. And when they made their exception of works of charity, they had in mind the relief of physical pain, the assisting of people in trouble, the doing of kindly, friendly acts, etc., etc. But surely this would throw down many bars which the advocates of Sunday laws are earnest to keep up. It would not merely allow, but include among the duties of Sunday charity every practicable provision for the decent and orderly entertainment of the poor on Sunday, such as the opening of free libraries, museums, and the like, the running of free excursions, etc. There are many good people who feel that they are doing an act of charity when they combine to send a lot of poor children to the country for a weekday, while nothing would induce them to have any part or lot in such a trip if it were made on Sunday. Again, the question might readily arise, whose charity is it that excuses work under the Sunday law? Assuming that it is a charity in me to charter a steamer and take down the river a number of poor families on Sunday, will that fact be a defense for the captain and the engineer of the vessel, who work for pay as on other days?
Could the company recover the money I had agreed to pay if the agreement was made on Sunday? These considerations are adduced with the view of enforcing the proposition that the saving of works of charity in the Sunday laws introduces an element of uncertainty as to their meaning and application, which renders their fair and uniform enforcement according to any fixed standard of interpretation impracticable, and would cause the courts to declare any other than a Sunday law absolutely void on account of the impossibility of construing its provisions by the light of any determinate principles known to the law. But if an impenetrable cloud is cast over the force and application of the Sunday law by the presence of this word charity, on what a bottomless, trackless sea are we launched by the use of that other word, necessity? The tossings and floundering, the hopeless seeking after a sign, the vain beating toward a harbor which does not exist, which we find in the cases on this subject, are really painful to a sensitive mind. We are even without a captain or a pilot whose authority to direct us on the way is undisputed. Who is to decide this question of necessity vel non in any given case, the judge or the jury? If the jury, is it to announce its conclusion with or without previous instruction by the court? You shall find in the reports decisions either way. 1. The question is one of fact in Indiana, Edgerton's case, 588, of law in Vermont, Lyon v. Strong, 219, and of law and fact in Alabama, Hooper v. Edwards, 528. Of course, in criminal cases, it is exclusively a question for the jury in those states where the jury is held to be the judge both of the law and the fact, as in Maryland. But assuming that we have settled this preliminary matter, who is to tell us what is or is not necessity? We come next to the question, how is he, or are they, to go about framing the definition for us and applying it to the differing states of fact? As in the case of charity, the first point to be settled is, whose necessity is meant? That of the one who does the work, or that of the one for whom it is done? Nobody can tell. We are apt to think of a doctor's work as necessary every day. But doctors know that they pay many visits on Sundays, as well as other days, which are wholly unnecessary, so far as the patients are concerned. Will the fact that the fee for such a visit is a necessity to the doctor's comfort exonerate him? Granting that it is not necessary for men to buy cigars, will it avail to plead that the seller cannot make a living without selling on Sunday? It is not necessary that the public should have the works of any writer, but suppose a man who writes for a living should find it impossible, with due regard for the real rest of nightly sleep, to get through his week's work without doing some of it on Sunday. Is that a necessity within the meaning of the statute? Is the fact that passengers are going on errands of necessity a defense for the engine driver or the locomotive engineer? It will not do to brush aside such points as these as presenting purely imaginary difficulties and raising issues never likely to come up for judicial determination. As a matter of fact, just such questions have more than once been involved in Sunday law cases, with the inevitable result of hopeless irreconcilability in the rulings. 1. In England, a barber is not excused by the fact that his Sunday shaving was a necessity for his customer. Phillips v. Tunes and F. 234. But it is said that here the apothecary is justified in selling a medicine which is a necessity to the sick. L. and N. R. R.'s case, 291. And besides, Sunday laws are kept on our statute books by the spirit of persecution which belongs to the union of church and state. The penalties prescribed in them are rarely exacted except when envy, hatred, malice, the meanest spite and jealousy prompt some Brownist to urge a prosecution. It is therefore important that all possible conditions which might make up a case under these laws should be thoroughly examined and sifted. It is gratifying, too, to find that from whatever standpoint we approach the Sunday statutes, the absurdity and utter unreasonableness of such legislation is equally apparent. But after we have ascertained who is to decide upon the necessity, and whose necessity it is that is to be decided upon, it remains still to settle some rules of principles, whereby the nature of the necessity may be defined, and a test furnished for its existence in any given case. And here, indeed, we are utterly lost, as any one of common sense might presuppose that we should be. It is not within the scope of this work exhaustively to expose the hopeless confusion and irreconcilable contradiction of all the cases wherein the judges have endeavored to attach some reasonable and definite meaning to this word. It is sufficient for the present purpose to give an idea of the manner in which the problem has been met and the extent to which it has been solved by stating that three points have been judicially settled. Namely, first, that the necessity of the Sunday law is not synonymous with convenience. 1 Allen 22, Duffy 1. Secondly, that it need not be absolute. 2 Flag 22, Milbury 243. And thirdly, that it must be imperious. 3 Omer's case, App 115. If the law, as thus settled, sounds nonsensical, we must remember, in justice to the courts, that it is rather a difficult matter to talk sense when attempting to construe and apply a statutory provision so nonsensical as this saving of works of necessity in the Sunday law. The only sensible thing that could be said of it, of course, would be to say that it is neither to be understood, explained, or applied, and that it renders the whole law void for uncertainty. But the courts have been so far, as a rule, too much under the influence of the zeitgeist of Brownism to occupy this frank and perfectly unimpeachable position. And it is not to be wondered at that in wrestling with the monstrous task laid upon them by the passage of Sunday laws, in endeavoring to comprehend the incomprehensible, to explain the inexplicable, to apply that which is incapable of application by human intelligence to human affairs. In a word, to make sense out of nonsense, they should, sometimes with a naive unconsciousness,
sometimes with a pretty evident suppressed consciousness of what they are doing, heap up more nonsense on the original mass supplied them by the legislature. It needs no argument to show that between absolute and imperious necessity, no human intelligence can discriminate, or that if we admit that our necessity is not absolute, then it ceases to have any practical value as an exception whatever, and becomes inextricably confused with convenience. The fact is, of course, that the distinction between a necessity and a convenience is altogether a matter of individual opinion, and can never by any man or set of men be determined for other people. It cannot be said that a man's life is necessary to him. In fact, to many, life is so far from being a necessity that it is an insupportable inconvenience and burden, as witness the suicides. Getting out of bed on Sunday morning is certainly not a necessity, and, if the Brownists could have their will, there would be far more inconveniences out of it than in it for other people during the day. Sunday meals are by no means a necessity. Any man can go for 24 hours without eating. True, it is convenient for us to take our meals on Sunday, just as on other days. But it is expressly said that convenience is not enough. The Brownists have always fought with tooth and nail against the running of public vehicles on Sunday. But if riding be not necessary, certainly walking is equally a matter of mere convenience.
The case is bad enough when we thus deal with men in general. It is much worse when we come to deal with the different classes of society, when we remember that heredity and habit and circumstances may make that an imperious necessity to hundreds, which to hundreds more may be a mere superfluity, or perhaps even objectionable. The equality of all men before the law, that great boast of American freemen, disappears at once. The law becomes a respecter of persons, like that of Russia or Germany. There are distinctions of race to be considered. Many an American is satisfied to observe Sunday by taking his whiskey out of a jug behind a closet door. But that excellent and most desirable citizen, the industrious German, is deprived of a valued privilege when he is prevented from buying his beer fresh and drinking it at table with his family. There are distinctions of class, and this inseparable and essential feature of all Sunday laws, that they are class legislation, discriminating against one portion of the community and in favor of another, and practically setting up for one day in every week a privileged order among American citizens, is perhaps the most hateful and despicable of all their hateful and despicable results. In every case but one to be mentioned presently, the discrimination is against the poor man and in favor of the rich one. To stop the horse cars from running does not affect the life of those who can order a carriage whenever they want to ride, but it at once makes a sharp distinction between them and their fellows who are thereby compelled to trudge on foot for miles or else remain cooped up in their narrow tenements on the only day they have to enjoy the beauties and benefits of the country. It makes little difference to one with a fine house full of works of art and interesting books whether the public libraries and museums, etc., are opened or closed on Sunday. But to shut them on that day converts him into a member of an order in the state, having advantages and opportunities of which others are debarred at the only time that they could possibly avail themselves of them. The writer sincerely believes that this is the real reason why the grinding tyranny and cruelty of Sunday laws has so long been endured by the people, that their oppression falls exclusively on that great toiling, patient, long-suffering, voiceless mass of mankind who have no organ of their grievances and whose real interests and wants are little consulted, even in our model republic. He believes that if a serious attempt were ever made to interfere under these laws with the lives of the wealthy and powerful, as the lives of the poor and humble are interfered with from time to time under them, the Sunday law people would be immediately given their choice between repeal and revolution. Yet, let the poor be somewhat consoled. If they are at a disadvantage as compared with the rich in the matter of mere comfort or the enjoyment of life under the Sunday laws, it appears that when it comes to taking care of what they have, they are decidedly a privileged class. A learned judge of Vermont makes the following invaluable contribution to the elucidation of this knotty question of necessity.
The individual condition and necessities of each man may go far to determine whether it is his duty to labor on Sunday to save property from destruction. The saving of a piece of property to one man might prevent great misery and suffering to himself and family. To another, it might be of no consequence. So that, before we can settle whether a man is indictable or not under a Sunday law for extinguishing a fire which he discovers consuming his house, we must ascertain just how imperiously necessary it is to him that that particular house should be saved. If he has plenty of insurance on it, it is obvious that no real necessity for saving it exists. If he has plenty of money and another house to move into at once, then the saving of that particular house is to him a mere matter of convenience, and mere convenience is not pleadable in defense to a charge of using water in buckets and working a pump on Sunday. This single preference of the poor man over the rich one under the operation of the Sunday laws is, however, judicially established, and that in but a single state. It may be confidently asserted that no legislature in passing such a law has in contemplation the constrainment of any but the common herd, who are, in fact, the chief victims of these vicious enactments. The odious character of Sunday laws as class legislation has been frankly recognized in England. It was said, "The statute does not apply to all persons, but to persons having ordinary callings which they exercise on the Sunday." 1 Begbie Verses. Levy, 130. That is to say, nice people were not to be bothered by it, but only poor devils who have to work for a living, and not even professional or gentleman workers either, but only the lower classes. "For," asked the court in another case, with justifiable indignation, "can it be contended that an attorney is a tradesman?" 2 King versus Whitmarsh, and C. 596. And what is here frankly avowed of the English law is true of every Sunday law in the United States, whether such an effect is intended by its supporters or not. Every such law touches the life and abridges the liberty of the poor man, while it leaves the rich man, to all intents and purposes, as free as on any other day. An examination of the cases will show that the necessities with which the courts have been called upon to deal in connection with Sunday laws are not really necessities, even in the most liberal acceptation of that term. They are simply conveniences, comforts, part of the richness, largeness, enjoyment of lives that, under the most favorable conditions, are poor and narrow and miserable enough. The cruelty of interfering with the scant opportunity for such things which the toiling masses have is hard to bring home to those who inflict it, because they are themselves perfectly comfortable on Sunday. There is something shockingly cold-blooded and heartless about this American class legislation, the wanton discomfort it works in the alleys, while leaving the life of the avenues untouched. It may be said of Sunday laws that not one of them has ever been passed from a worthy motive. Of what may be called general laws of this character, bigotry and self-righteousness constitute the source. Of special laws, the spirit is that of laziness or cheating. Thus, in a Western state, lazy barbers got a special act passed, making their work illegal on Sunday, because industrious rivals worked on that day, which they desired to spend in loafing, and the competition annoyed them. In Maryland, certain icemen who desired to cheat their employers by getting from the latter 7 days' pay for 6 days' work had an act passed making the delivery of ice on Sunday unlawful. Now, in the heat of the summer, ice comes as near to being a necessity in the stifling byways of Baltimore as anything can be. But observe the result of this outrageous law. Rich people, with ample facilities for preserving ice over Sunday, protected themselves easily enough by simply doubling their usual orders on Saturday night. But the poor, having no place to keep more than one small piece, simply go without it, and drink warm water on the Christian Sabbath. The Sunday law, then, is one thing for the German and another thing for the American. It is one thing for the rich man and another thing for the poor man. The attempt to apply it in practice destroys, of necessity, that equality before the law which lies at the very foundation of American jurisprudence, and fatally discriminates between classes in the community. But how much more forcibly is this effect manifested when we come to the case of individual men? How utterly unequal must any application of the law be, how utterly absurd any attempt to apply it as between one man and another?
Men who belong to the same races or classes often differ widely in their ideas of what is necessary for them, and individual differences herein are infinite in number. The determination of a judge or jury as to what was or was not necessary in a given case might work in great hardship to one man and affect another not in the slightest. Even assuming that a judge or jury could be found capable of dealing with such a question on any rational basis.